Bonjour et bienvenue sur Ainsi Bon Terme, le podcast qui parle avec des personnes expertes de la communication scientifique. Aujourd'hui, notre invité est anglophone, donc l'interview qui va suivre sera en anglais, mais sous-titrée en français. On reçoit Kathleen, que vous ne connaissez très probablement pas parce qu'elle travaille dans l'ombre. Elle a été productrice, puis productrice exécutive de SciShow pendant 10 ans. Alors, SciShow. SciShow, c'est une chaîne YouTube anglophone de quasi 8 millions d'abonnés qui parle de science. Et je vous invite à aller voir au moins un ou deux épisodes avant de commencer ce podcast, ça vous donnera un petit peu plus de contexte. Et cette chaîne, SciShow donc, a été créée par Hank Green. On va parler de lui dans le podcast, donc il faut que je vous présente Hank. C'est un créateur très prolifique en général dans la sphère de la science. Il a fondé énormément de choses, dont une compagnie appelée Complexly, qui est celle qui produit SciShow, la fameuse chaîne YouTube dont on parle aujourd'hui. Et comme le nom de la compagnie va revenir dans le podcast, c'est pour ça que je vous la présente. Et donc Kathleen a été parmi les premières employées de Complexly et donc de SciShow, où elle a eu vraiment plusieurs rôles, l'occasion d'en discuter. Dans ce podcast, on va donc parler des secrets de la création d'une chaîne qui publie une vidéo scientifiquement vérifiée tous les jours. On va parler de l'organisation du travail dans l'équipe, des objectifs de SciShow, des choix de sujets, que ce soit des sujets doux ou des vrais sujets de société, leur cycle de production, de l'idée à la publication, le storytelling, les miniatures, le script, la structure, la durée des vidéos, etc., etc. Qu'est-ce qui fait un bon présentateur ou une bonne présentatrice? Comment gérer le fait qu'il y a plusieurs personnes qui présentent, les financements, etc., etc. Vous voyez, ça va être un podcast riche. Mais avant de commencer, permettez-moi de vous présenter pour la toute première fois dans l'histoire de ce podcast notre sponsor. Et il se trouve qu'il a été très utile puisque l'interview n'a pas été enregistrée dans mon studio. Kathleen et moi, à ce moment-là, on se parle en visio et la connexion était absolument horrible. Sur la deuxième moitié de l'interview, je la voyais même plus. Et vous ne vous en rendrez même pas compte parce que j'ai utilisé une nouvelle plateforme, le sponsor Riverside. Riverside, en fait, il enregistre les deux flux vidéo et audio localement, de sorte que, finalement, la qualité de l'Internet n'est plus du tout si pertinente que ça. Après l'enregistrement, moi, je récupère la vidéo et l'audio en qualité originale de chaque côté. Ça a clairement sauvé cet épisode, il n'aurait pas été diffusable sinon. Petite note, j'ai utilisé et payé pour leurs produits pour cette interview-là, avant même d'être contacté par eux. C'est un heureux hasard qu'on collabore aujourd'hui. Au-delà de l'enregistrement local, je pense que vous pourriez être intéressé par la transcription francophone. Un des grands besoins qu'on a quand on fait des interviews de n'importe qui, c'est d'arriver à sélectionner les éléments les plus importants. Et pour ça, il faut avoir une transcription de bonne qualité pour arriver à travailler le texte derrière. Les anglophones, eux, ils ont ça depuis super longtemps. Mais nous, en francophonie, ça marche super mal. Et là, je viens de tester en mettant une vidéo d'interview en ligne sur la plateforme de Riverside. Donc, en passant, même pas besoin que l'enregistrement ait eu lieu sur la plateforme. Et la transcription est nickel. Même en français, même avec des accents, ils enlèvent les répétitions et les ponctuations sont au bon endroit. Donc, transcription bonne, mais en plus, on peut sélectionner des bouts de texte qui nous intéressent et faire l'édition du podcast ou de l'interview que vous avez directement à partir du texte. C'est-à-dire que vous ne faites même pas les coupes, non, vous sélectionnez le texte que vous ne voulez pas, que vous voulez. Ça fait des coupes de façon super propre et bim, vous avez votre montage. Il n'y a plus qu'à exporter le texte ou la vidéo comme vous voulez. Si ça vous intéresse d'essayer, que ce soit pour des podcasts, des communications internes à votre entreprise ou des transcriptions d'interviews, que sais-je, vous pouvez aller vous inscrire gratuitement via le lien dans les notes ou dans la description et vous aurez 15% de réduction avec le code BON TERME. Revenons maintenant à notre entrevue. Si vous voulez savoir comment on produit une chaîne de science sur YouTube qui a 8 millions d'abonnés, vous devriez obtenir pleine satisfaction. Je m'arrête là et je laisse enfin la parole à Kathleen parce qu'elle en parle en si bon terme.
I saw on LinkedIn that you had several title roles at SciShow, from editor to producer to and so on and so forth. Can you tell me what are all of these titles? What did you do in all of this on all of this work?
I started at SciShow in 2012 as a video editor, and that's what I did, is edit videos. And then it was a really small team, so then I pretty soon started filming videos, and we had two people who did graphics and animation, and the team structure kind of changed shortly after I started, and so they started teaching me how to do more graphics, and so then the job sort of evolved into what we called a creative team or video maker. And it was three of us who did everything like from film to edit the video, everything in production and post-production, film, edit the video, and add graphics, make animations. The graphic side
but
of
not
things.
Not writing.
But not writing. No, we had one in-house person when I started who was the main writer and really the main editor, and then a bunch of freelance writers. They would cycle their pieces through him, Blake DiPestino, and he would make everything in the Sideshow voice and fact check. And that's way too much for one person to do. So over time, we started expanding both sides of those, of that team, of the editorial side and the post-production side. And graphics was never my super strong suit. But we started doing these talk shows, which are really production heavy, a lot of scheduling, a lot of coordinating and planning, and then a lot of directing people who are not necessarily used to being on camera. And then a multi-camera edit, which we had never really done before. And those are all things that I am more trained in than the graphic side of things. At the time when I started, we had, when I started as a video editor, we had 4 episodes a week, I think. We did what we called a dose, which is a short, like 3 to 5 minute video. An infusion was a longer video, about 10 minutes. And then we had a weekly news episode that was like 7 to 10 minutes. And then we had a weekly breaking news episode, which was like 2-3 minutes on something that Blake would like learn about something, write about it. We would shoot it that day. I would edit it that day. It would go to graphics the next day and it would be out the next day. So
this was with how many people?
So it was Hank, the host. Michael Aranda was our script supervisor. Blake was our writer and editor. Like it was like our whole editorial department for that episode. And then I was the video editor. We had a graphics person. We had a designer and an animator. So the designer would make the assets and then the animator would animate them.
So 7 people for 4 videos a week.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
So not all full time. So it was like.
Yes.
4 of us, I think, were full time.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was when you were a producer, is that it?
So that was when I was a video editor. And then
video editor, okay.
Yeah, and so then we noticed that those news episodes were always, almost always about space, because NASA has a really good publicity department, and they would always put out information. There's always new cool things to talk about with space. And so pretty quickly, I think I had been there about 1.5 years when we started talking about wanting to do a space channel. That were because we wanted to talk about other things, but we didn't want to ignore space, and it just felt like we had enough to talk about to start a new channel. So when we were about to launch SciShow Space, that's when I started hosting. But right before it launched, that's when we decided, when Hank decided that I should be the producer, because it was just going to be enough going on that we needed like one point of contact for production and post-production.
So can you explain what a producer is?
Yeah, yeah. So a producer is a catch-all term for someone who does lots of things, and there's lots of different kinds of producers. I actually wrote a Crash Course episode about what a producer is.
Oh, yeah?
If anybody's interested ever. Crash Course did a series about film, and I wrote a handful of the episodes, and one about producing was really fun to write, because producer just, it just means like, if you break the word down, it just means maker. You just make things. But usually it's the person who is like organizing a team and making sure everything, especially with a series, like making sure everything's flowing, making sure everybody has what they need to get their work done, keeping us like on budget and running smoothly. And then as you have more people, you have more producers. And so when it was just 2 channels, I was the producer, and then I had the creative team. And SciShow was part of a startup, so we were always kind of like in classic like startup mode, like people would just start doing more work than they were originally assigned to make sure things were working, and then we would adjust their title based on that. Okay. And so like I was sort of producing the talk shows, and then Hank was like, I think you're just the producer. But also we were like not always following like established systems that are in the film industry. It was like, we have Blake, who is the head of editorial. So I was the producer of like production and post-production for a long time. And then as we added more channels and added more projects, and the team just got bigger and bigger. And so then I became the senior producer, and we had different producers of different things. And then while in 2021, our editorial team had grown, our post-production team had grown, our hosting team had grown, and we made it through the pandemic. Our main studio for SciShow is in Montana, and so we really lucked out that we had a few days' notice of when lockdown was probably going to happen. And so leading up to that, I had kind of packed this studio in a box just in case, like, everybody had to quarantine, and then Hank could just go in and, like, grab the studio, and I would walk him through over Google Hangout on how to set it up. But we got word that it was going to, like, lockdown was going to happen one day, and we had like a day, and everybody just like masked up. We were super careful. And one of my producers, Hiroka, and then one of my camera sound people, Tuna Medish, the three of us went into Hank's garage and set up the studio. We like got everything in focus, and we were like, you'll just push the button, but don't mess with this. and then we would just join him like this via Zoom to direct him. But we had gotten through all that and everything with the team kind of bifurcated in like editorial and production, and it just was not working anymore. It was causing headaches all the time. And so we decided to like change up how the editorial department works and put that under a producer. And then we sort of realized pretty quickly that that's no longer a senior producer. It's an executive producer, because I was also in charge of the budget and the higher level business decisions. And the more producers on the ground were doing like the hands-on work of like running the team and making the like day-to-day decisions. So a producer is someone who leads a team that makes a thing, and the buck sort of stops with the producer on a lot of decisions.
That's
and they're
wide.
Kind of balancing, like making sure this is going to be seen, making sure it's going to make money, or at least stick to budget, depending on like how much control the producer has over things.
So when you started, you were only three people full time, I think, three, four people. And now in 2023, when you left SciShow, how many people full time was there?
Yeah. So when I started, the whole company, they were making SciShow and Crash Course.
Okay.
And the whole Missoula company, I should say, was, I think I was like the sixth person.
It's not separated between SciShow and Crash Course and everything.
Yeah, so Nick Jenkins, okay, who is the executive producer of Study Hall now, he was doing all the filming and directing, and Hank was our only host. And so he did all the filming and directing for both SciShow and Crash Course, and then he was doing editing for both. No, somebody else was doing editing for SciShow, who I replaced. And he was doing editing for Crash Course. And then, like, as each project grew, it was like, okay, we kind of need a Crash Course team and a SciShow team. And then we started new things, and those needed dedicated teams. We have this the conference room in the Missoula office. We have this table that you can comfortably fit, like, eight people around. And that was, like, we would have our all-house staff meetings, like, around that. Mm-hmm. And I think there were six people. And there were two or three in Indianapolis, where John is based. So Crash Course, the humanities Crash Course episodes were filmed there. That was before DFTBA was like its own separate company, and that moved to Missoula, which is like Hank and John's merch company. So there was a lot of overlapping of things, like the office manager did a lot of different
things. I do realize, but my question about how many people is there is not that easy to answer.
Yeah. And so this is before it was called Complexly, but then a few years ago, they renamed the company Complexly, which is very fitting because of how everything is very complex.
So there is a lot of people in SciShow now, but we don't know how many.
So in 2012, it was like, I think I was the only person who full-time just worked on SciShow. There were other people that touched it as part of their workflow. So like probably three or four other people that touched it regularly. I just did SciShow. Sometimes I would help out with Crash Course a little bit. In 2023, the full-time staff is about 15 people. So that's the editorial team, the production and post-production team. And then the hosts are like, so there's about 20 when you include the hosts. And with the freelance team of writers and script editors, it's probably regular, like 30, and then irregular, about 40.
That's
fact
a crowd.
Checkers. I don't mean to leave the fact checkers out. There, we also use freelance fact checkers.
Okay, that's a crowd.
real.
So you've reached a point where you don't know the name of everybody.
I think I do.
You
I can't
do?
Count. Yeah, I feel like I could count them all.
Okay.
If I list all right. them all. And they might
you're
have
a good
new...
You're a good producer then, because I'm not sure every producer knows the name of everybody.
It's a really involved, like, caring bunch. And so I did get to, like, interact with most of them. Not all of the freelance writers all the time, but I know their scripts and their work really well.
Okay. What is the main objective of SciShow? Is it, like, to get views, the growth, the quality of information, entertainment? What do you have it, like, very clear our main objective is?
Yeah, it's the main objective is to spark curiosity, and to help people imagine that the world is knowable. The belief of SciShow is that everyone is curious about science, but they might not know it. And so we do try to be really entertaining and play to, like, what you think you know, but actually it's more interesting than that, so that you can discover how curious you are about the world. I also think science, especially in the era of climate change, can be depressing or really overwhelming. But if you are aware that, oh, scientists are really smart and working on things all the time and working how to figure things out, like, then it doesn't seem as daunting, like, to think about how the world is, at least for me, it doesn't feel as daunting to think about how the world is changing, because we have caused a lot of destruction. But we can also learn and work together to cause a lot of change.
That's interesting that you're taking this example, because I don't feel like SciShow is going on that kind of topics, or maybe, you know, in a positive way, or you're not like face on we're all going to die, because I don't think it would be useful anyway. So you're talking about climate change, but how much do you talk about climate change? And is it a choice to have a different voice about it?
Yeah. So I am no longer the executive producer of SciShow. Nicole Sweeney is, and she knows that I'm talking to you about SciShow, and I am still working with the SciShow team on a project that is very focused on climate change and weather, and how the extremes of weather are affecting us. So that is why that is the example top of mind for me, because I'm deep in this
okay,
project
I
that
see.
Is really focused
I see,
on climate change. But yeah, I think that you're not going to grab someone who doesn't think they're interested in science with the heavy hitting climate change story.
Yeah, so it doesn't work with your main objective, which is to spark curiosity. Is that it?
I feel like it's different kind of levels. Sometimes we're like, this is like a 101 episode. It's like, you were curious about this, or maybe this is like even just like a cocktail hour like type thing. Like, I always think of the episode about how asparagus, if your pee smells like asparagus, like what that means about the enzyme in your body. That is like a funny, like, anecdote that somebody could share at a cocktail party. And so it's like that sort of can spark your interest, but that's like an entry point into SciShow. And then we think about all the different levels of buy-in that our audience has. And so something that's more like you're already bought into what we're doing and you watch SciShow a lot, we want to have episodes for that group too, that they're like, we know about how asparagus makes your pee smell, you know, like, or how you're able to smell your asparagus pee. And there's different points that we're trying to hit with different types of episodes. Does that answer?
Okay. Yes, it does.
That question?
So,
okay.
But I'm going to broaden it.
Okay.
How do you choose the topics then?
It's a little bit of a brawl.
A brawl? I don't know what this means.
Like a fight to choose the topics. So the editorial team is 5 people, and then the producing team is 4 people. They meet every week, and every person on the editorial team brings a certain number of story ideas that they're pitching. A lot of them are from writers, freelance writers, and then one of the editors or our in-house writer is pitching it for them. And so they've done a lot of pre-research. They're like, this is the arc that we think this story is going to take. This is why it's interesting or will be interesting to our audience. This is the takeaways we want the audience to have. And they walk us through it. And then the producers and the editorial director, a man named Daniel Comiskey, they respond and ask questions, try to poke holes in a narrative, make sure SciShow is saying something new about it. Sometimes we're like, oh, that's cool, but we just saw a Vox video about that. We don't need to do that. Mm-hmm. Then we kind of discuss together. The editors advocate for each other's if they get really excited about one. And then we populate our schedule with that. And a lot of times we send them back because we're like, this isn't like, it doesn't feel like it has a satisfying payoff. Like, we don't want people to spend 6 minutes with us and then be like, what was the point of that? And so a lot of it is like storytelling, tweaking. A lot of it is making sure that we're doing like getting a good coverage of different things, because SciShow, for the main SciShow channel, could focus on anything. It's not just one subject. And so we might get like a lot of space pitches. Space has now been absorbed back into the main SciShow channel. And so we're like, God, that's too much space right now. Or like, oh, this is a cool idea, but not until spring, you know, like, and so it's a lot of like thinking about where our audience is when they're going to be hearing and seeing these videos as well.
When you are in this room for this meeting, how much time is there between this meeting and the publishing?
I would say about 8 weeks.
8 weeks. Okay. So that's why you really have seasons in
yeah,
mind.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And some of them definitely are like fast tracked for sure. But I think ideally it's about 8 weeks.
Okay. I've heard you talk about arc, about narrative, and I don't think you would associate naturally SciShow with storytelling. So can you tell me how do you include storytelling into SciShow?
Yeah. Sometimes we talk about it as the counterintuitive. So we really want the episode to be satisfying by starting with something that feels counterintuitive and getting it to the point where you're like, oh, that does make sense. You've like gone on this journey of you're like, what? Like, convince me that these two things are related. So there's one called The Rarest Cancer, because there's only one case of it. It's really a story of like how scientists study a thing that's new, and also what we deem a cancer, if I'm remembering right. This is an episode from about a year ago. You know, you could be like, this is how cancer works, or this is how scientists study cancer. But by framing it around, here's a cancer where there's only one case, one known case of this kind of cancer, that doesn't make sense at first. And so we're using that frame to like help, like, let's focus really specifically, and then we'll back out and you'll have like a bigger understanding of how cancer works and how we study it.
So it's much more about finding the right angle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The right
making point sure
of
we're
entry.
Having satisfying storytelling within that, because worst case scenario, the right angle is clickbait. You know, that you're just like, you say something that sounds provocative, but then you don't actually deliver on that promise.
So does that mean that you work on title and thumbnails even before the script is written?
We try to. It's really hard. And the editorial team rightfully is really resistant to doing that, because they're like, I can't say if that, well, because they're all trained scientists. And so they're like, well, I don't know, I need to be open to discovery. But it's also really helpful for the producers to imagine the episode and help like make sure it's going to be a satisfying video if we know what they're envisioning the arc to be. And so that's what I mean when it's kind of a brawl. There's like a tension there that, so we will try to have, we'll have a working title. Usually it often changes, but we try to make it really clear. People who like to write SciShow scripts are people who like to share knowledge. And so we can run the risk of like trying to include just way too much in a video. So it's not actually that helpful. And so we try to make it really clear, like, this is what we're talking about in this video with that working title. And then be like, okay, what is the true title here as we work through it? Sometimes we do have a thumbnail in mind at the beginning. Hank really works that way. So if he pitches something, he usually pitches a thumbnail alongside it.
So the question of the title and thumbnail is heavy on YouTube. of course, because that's the reason why people are clicking. So do you have a process for it? Do you have someone that is dedicated for it? Do you have a brainstorm just for title and thumbnail? Do you have a process that is very specific to title and thumbnail?
We are always trying to work on that and figure that out more, but it is a whole step in the process of working on the thumbnail. The thumbnail has to be approved separate from the video. We used to, when our team was really tiny, we'd be like, and there, here's a thumbnail. And we would like just throw it up like right before. But now it's a more dedicated process and we go back and update titles and thumbnails.
Oh yeah.
Periodically we try to, you know, and we really try to update thumbnails first before we update titles, because if you update the title, it confuses YouTube and sort of resets your metadata. Mm-hmm. So we try to only use that when it makes sense. But it is something I know the team is constantly working on, is how to work on that more and dedicate the time to it, because it is really time consuming to come up with a good thumbnail that
Agreed.
Is honest and interesting. And
yeah. But do you allow yourself to be clickbaity?
We like to call it click bacon.
Click bacon.
Yeah. That's so nice. Click bait is a thing that you're like, oh, that was like, I thought it was going to be good, but it wasn't good. Uh-huh. But bacon, like, it smells really good. It gets you all hungry. And then you eat it. And it, if you're a meat eater, it is really good. It delivers on it.
Click bacon. I'm loving it. Do you have a veggie version?
Click too. Yeah.
Click broccoli.
Yeah.
Nice. Do you have like an order of what is going on the script? Like first you start with this, and then so is it structured the same way every time?
Yeah, good question. There are different structures, but there are structures that we come back to. Alex Billow, who's one of our longest running editors, really tries to think of it as a 3-act structure and writes in that way, like sets up the promise of what you're going to learn, gets into the nitty gritty, and then wraps it back up again of like, okay, here's the payoff and here's what you've learned. But he does it in such a way that it's really subtle. And so a lot of times, like, people will go in and try to make corrections and he's like, no, that breaks my 3-act structure. And you're like, oh, here, I see what you're doing. So it's really fun. Like, his script's always like, he really leads you there, which is really cool. But we do different lengths of episodes. And so some of them are different. Like we do like a quick question and that's like a 1-act, you know, like it's just answering this question. So the question has to be really interesting. Those pitches for either shorts or the like kind of shorter videos, those I would say take the most time because they're doing a lot of the writing of the script in the pitch process. Whereas a longer like 10-15 minute video, they're like, and this is what we're going to explore and we'll know more as we get into it.
Is it a real choice to have different video length? Or is it just because some authors are working with long text and some others don't?
No, it's a programmed choice. So like if you pay close attention, you'll notice that the length matches the day of the week. And so on Sundays, there's a list show. On Mondays, there's a short dose. On Tuesdays, there's a short QQ. On Wednesdays, there's a longer episode. I'm sure the schedule is a little bit different now. And part of that's just planning, because it's like we just have a big team and we want to put out as many episodes as possible. And we know that there's some stuff we want to cover that we only need a short video for. There's some stuff that we want to cover that we want to do a longer video for. Managing schedule-wise, we do it that way. So everyone knows what to expect from what kind of video it is, like, and knows what to expect from their workload.
So when someone is pitching an idea, is this person pitching for a length as well? Like saying,
they
this
are.
Is going to be, okay, yeah.
They are. And that's like a huge part of the conversation, is that they're like, I think this is a dose length, which is a roughly 5-minute episode. And then we'll be like, oh, I think this is maybe an infusion. Or actually, I think this is part of a list show. And you need 5 other things that are related but different to make this interesting. And so with a list show, we were asking about form. We don't want to just hit the same note over and over again. So we're like, does this build and then bring it home? Or does it surprise us at the end? So we're asking a lot of things like that. Or for a dose, a lot of times we talk about a 3 things dose. And it's like 3 reasons why we're all evolving to be crabs or something like that. And so we're like, okay, this is like a way of thinking about the three-act structure. Or if it's like a history, we're like, oh, this is a history, but there's some mystery to it. So like, are we like building the intrigue in the beginning enough so that it pays off at the end? Or this is a history and it's going to be really boring if we just tell it like this happened, this happened, this happened. Like, what is the other angle? So we talk a lot about story and format, but we don't have like a set formula that each script follows. We just have different versions. We're like, we have different phrases for things that we're like, I think this is a biography episode and I'm fococusing on this person. A great minds episode is what we call those. And I'm fococusing on this person, but those ones like also have to have a science lesson, not just a story of the person's life.
Okay. Back to the story thing, because you're using this word a lot. Whenever people are thinking about story, it has a main character and it has something that is happening. But in the kind of story you're describing, it's much more like having something surprising. So how do you define what is storytelling in the context of SciShow, which is different than the storytelling we have in mind when we read a fiction book?
Yeah. I think it's sometimes we use the phrase narrative instead, journey, if like that can be more helpful. Sometimes we are like, I think this video is missing a hero, and we will talk about having a main character to like get us through. Usually when we do that, the hero is like a bug or like a rocket ship or something. It's like, what is the thing that we're tracking throughout, that and the hero is the thing that change happens to, you know? And so sometimes with a SciShow episode, the change is happening to the viewer, that it's like, we are explaining, we're like equipping you with this amount of knowledge so that you care about the payoff at the end. So it's a little bit of a, like, it's more like lean forward content than lean back content. It's like, we're wanting to set up that you're invested in understanding what's going to happen with this thing.
It's interesting what you're saying is that the hero is actually the viewer, but the viewer is not in the video. So the hero is untold and unknown in the video, but you are the one creating the story. So are you trying to make the viewer like being part of the video? I don't know how I should phrase that.
This is cool. I had never thought of it exactly that way, but that feels right to me. Okay. And I also should flag, and I think everyone on the SciShow editorial team would flag too, that this is really hard to talk about, like, and that I talk about it differently than they do. And we all talk about it a little bit differently from each other. And so that makes it fun, and it makes it so we discover and make room for space for things to happen. But
I do teach science communication as well. And so storytelling is part of what I teach, but I had never thought about what we just said. That's why I'm always curious about how people define their storytelling, because it everybody has a different view about it. And it's always interesting to hear how you view it.
Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't thought about, because I'm like, the change is happening to the viewer in that, like, you have this much information, and then by the end, we want you to have this much information. But sometimes we need you to, like, we need to teach you why you care about this thing in the first minute.
Yes.
So that you're like, oh, that it worked out, like, at the end, or you're heartbroken that it didn't work out. But I hadn't thought about how that makes the viewer the hero.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of strings to be pulled from here.
Yeah. And sometimes we have to do it over time. Like, I always think about, we did this episode on gravitational waves, and it was just like a quote unquote toolbox episode where we're like, we have got to explain to you how gravitational waves work, because they just kept coming up. And so we were talking about them in every video, and we're like, we need to teach our main audience why we care about these, why we keep talking about them. And so, like, I think if I remember that right, like, Einstein was the hero of that one. Like, he had proposed that gravitational waves were a thing. We were pretty sure they were a thing, but we hadn't actually proved that. But that, you know, like, and then he corrected himself and was like, no, they're not a thing. And then, so, like, taking you on the journey and of being like, oh, no, they are. And now you live in a world where you know gravitational waves are mm-hmm. real. Einstein was, I guess, like maybe more of the narrative device and like mm-hmm. we are the ones that are caring about where we are in the grand scheme of it.
Yeah. So this is easier to find where the hero is in the story when you have one hero in the story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Okay. That's very interesting. You mentioned that all the authors are scientists first.
Yeah.
So
that's true.
So do you have, because I know in people in the TV world that they don't like scientists to be the writers because we are not trained to be writers. We are trained mm-hmm. to do science, of course. And so they would much rather have writers working with scientists, working with humorists, people that do comedy mm-hmm. to add mm-hmm. some jokes, rather than having the scientist that is usually more serious than someone that is trained not to be. So why is this choice to have writers that are trained scientists?
Yeah, I think part of it is affordability. That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
You okay. know, and luckily there's a lot of, not a ton, but there's a fair amount of really smart scientists who go to school, get through their PhD, and realize, I really liked the writing about science part more than the lab work. Yep, yep. And so those people are incredibly valuable to mm-hmm. educational content. And they also keep us honest. Like we use fact checkers, but just having like five brilliant people all from different disciplines, they catch so many things. You know, they're mm-hmm. just like, they catch each other. They're like, oh, when you say it like this, a fact checker won't catch this, but that's actually a weird way to talk about this thing, you know, mm-hmm. just for keeping the scientific community in mind too. So it's a really hard role to hire for though, because it's easier to be a scientist or a comedy writer or, you know, like one thing. And it's a really interdisciplinary role that you have to be a good writer. You have to be like, have a lot of science background. One of our writers is, I don't know everybody's background off the top of my head super well. I know like the editorial director for SciShow isn't a scientist. He is a trained writer and journalist and long form like feature creative writer. And that was intentional. Like I was like, SciShow in a lot of ways is run like a magazine. Like it's a video magazine. So I need someone who understands that structure and like can pull that in. And then the full-time editorial staff, almost all of them are trained scientists and have done science work. One of them has an anthropology background and worked in museums in like science education before moving to SciShow. And so they complement each other really well, all of them. Like they're really good at keeping the audience in mind. It was a hard fight to find each of them. Like four of them I hired directly. One of them Alex has been there so long. I just got to weigh in late in the interview process. And I was like, yes, that's our person. It is hard to find them.
Yeah. So how do you make sure that this person is the right fit for you? Do you ask them to write the script and see if it works or based on something else? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a demanding process to apply mm-hmm. for SciShow editorial team. There's an editing test that we give you a script that we've made all problematic and
okay.
make sure you catch it, make sure you edit it in a way that makes sense to us. And then we have fact-checking tests for our fact-checkers. There's a lot of tests and we try really, really hard to be pretty sure that we're going to hire someone before we start giving them all these tests. But, because it is time consuming, and we value people's time.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, thorough interview process. You have to have great recommendations. Luckily more and more people are doing this kind of work though too. So it's like we're like, oh, you have experience in this. So that has helped.
And so you have many writers, but whenever I watch a SciShow video, I cannot tell that this video has been done by this person or mm-hmm. another person. It feels like it's always the same voice.
Yeah.
So is it something that that comes naturally with the kind of structure you're working with, or are the writers trying not to be too personal I would say.
Yeah.
In so how does it work to make it seem like it's one person behind it?
Yeah. Yeah, the editors, it's the editors. They bring it into the SciShow voice.
Okay.
And the writers sort of learn the SciShow voice all over time. And there are subtle differences. They will edit things differently or write things slightly differently. JD Voyek is one of our editors. And before she was an editor, when she was in grad school, she wrote for us. And we would purposely match her and I, me as a host for her writing, because we worked, you know, like I could, like, the jokes that she would put in were really charming and fun for me. And so we would play with them. Whereas like Reed Reimers, who's one of our hosts, he, like, it didn't work for him. And we would rewrite a little bit, or she would write to him. She did a great job of that too. But it was like, we're like, oh, it's fun when we match up JD and Caitlin. And so we would do that a lot. And so there's subtle differences for performance. I can tell who wrote something based on what it's about, like just because I know the different writers and their different interests. But the editors work really hard to train people in the SciShow voice and to like keep it in the SciShow voice. And it's rare that we'll put a host on a thumbnail.
Yeah, that was one of my questions actually on my list. And why is that?
Partially because we don't want, people are used to Hank. And Hank doesn't want to be the face of SciShow. He thinks that science should be the face of SciShow. And then we also don't want a video to do not as well because someone other than Hank hosted it. And so that was a decision when we started adding other hosts.
If you don't put anyone on the thumbnails, you're not, your audience is not getting used to this person neither, if you're not putting it in a thumbnail.
That's true. I think in general, I would tell, like, I think it is not considered best practices to not put hosts in the thumbnail. But it's a conscious SciShow decision to like that we're like the science is more interesting than the host is what we are trying to say with that. But we will sometimes, like, a video just came out about how chemo is changing and Hank is in the thumbnail of that, which makes sense because it would be confusing if you clicked on that and it was Rose and you're like, but I know Hank has cancer. Why is he okay? You know, like we don't want anybody to get worried about Hank, or like we also want to like understand people's expectations about something.
Mm-hmm. So we were talking about hosts and writers working together so that some writer will adapt the jokes to the host. And is it also going the other way around, like the host is reading something on the prompter, on the script, and making changes on the fly? Or is it like a no-no?
No, they will change it all the time. Hank always changes things on the fly. He's really good at it, so sometimes you won't even notice. So the script supervisor is like tracking what he says, and then it's like, oh my gosh, hold on. He has to double check that what he said is still accurate and okay. A lot of times we'll have the editor on Slack and be checking with them when we're filming to make sure what we're doing makes sense. And then a lot of times hosts will just do it in their own voice. Everybody has their own thing that they sort of slip up and struggle on that is hard to say. So they might just rephrase things. Usually we try to encourage the host to just do it as written at least once and then try to do it a different way just in case we need to change it back.
Mm-hmm.
But the hosts definitely bring their personality to it as much as available.
Talking about the host, so we talked about what is a good writer. What is the good host?
Yeah, a good host understands the material they're explaining. And I have been a host and I am not a scientist. And so I had to do a lot of homework beforehand to like make sure I understood it enough to really explain it and not feel like I was reading and feel like I'm directly talking to one person. We try to make sure the hosts don't feel like they're too presentery because, like, you're probably watching on your phone or, like, on your laptop while you eat cereal, you know, like, it's, we want it to be a one-on-one interaction, not a one-on-100, 200, like 100,000 interaction. Feeling that, like, engagement and real thinking that's happening when they're talking because they are reading a script off of a teleprompter, but we don't want them, we don't want it to just be coming out of their mouth, you know, like, but actually like real thoughts coming out of their mouth.
So a host is this person recording like 10 videos a day?
Hank can do, we think of them, since we have different lengths of episodes, we think about them as in units. And so like a dose is like a unit. So like anything double a dose, like an infusion or a lisha would be would be 2 units. Hank can really comfortably do 7 or 8.
Okay.
And so, and then everybody else can do 2 to 4. And then you start to get kind of loopy. you're just like, it takes longer. You're like, words start smooshing and things like that. It depends on the host, but it's usually somewhere in there. So Hank gets a lot. Everybody else just records like a little more often.
Okay. And is Hank that good? Because it's been a while, to say the least, that is doing this.
yeah. And our whole system is based on how he hosts, you know, like so much. Sideshow voice has definitely evolved over the years, but it's based on how he started doing it too. Mm-hmm. So everybody does it a little bit differently. But
how would you say that Sideshow voice changed?
I think it's slowed down a bit. And it's still pretty fast, but it used to be really fast. I think it's gotten gentler and nicer as the team has grown. Hank is very nice and has always caught, like, one of the first shoots I ever sat in on, there was a joke. I was really new and there was a joke in a script that I was uncomfortable with as a woman. And I was like, I'm going to have to say something about that. But I just like, I will just see how he delivers it. But if he does it, I'm going to say something. And he read the line and then was like, ugh, and just changed it. Like he cut the joke immediately, which was like so wonderful. And I was like, okay, I'm in the right place. But as the team has grown, just more people catch stuff that you're like, oh, I don't like how that. Somebody could be watching our video and that would hurt them, you know? And so I think just as the team has grown, we've gotten better at being thoughtful about everyone in our audience.
That's nice. That's very nice.
Yeah. I think so, yeah.
So I'm going to switch to production and maybe post-production. I've noticed that you don't have any music in the video.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
Why not?
Part of that is because of the speed.
Okay.
And because it's just wall-to-wall talking, we thought it would be overwhelming, especially for, like, non-native English speakers to have music in there as well. And that's pretty much it. I think over time that might change, but Sideshow is, like, a factory. We crank out a lot of videos. Complexly shares 2 sound designers. And so it's just right now.
It's not enough.
It's not an option, but I wouldn't be surprised if that changed over time. We used to put more sound effects and things in when we were doing like 4 videos a week, because I would just put them in and I didn't have to go through a sound person. If you listen back to those episodes, the mixing is not great. the levels are so much better now, and that is more worthwhile to us than the funny little like cat meowing that I would put in or something. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that changes over time, because I think it, as Sideshow introduces new types of videos and the audience evolves what they want.
You said that it's a factory, which is interesting because it does feel like it when you pull out so many videos a week. So there's always this question about quality over quantity or quantity over quality. Mm-hmm. So why is this choice to have it as a factory? Is it because of money, just because you need to output some videos? Or is it because you want to flood the internet with good content, which is a good reason as well? Or is it, I don't know, is there like a specific reason on why it has become a factory and not maybe 1 video a week that would be like, you know, a documentary style video? Mm-hmm. So why the factory side?
Yeah. So because we're greedy, I think that we try to do all the things, like both quality and quantity. Mm-hmm. When Sideshow started in early 2012, there was space for us to do a lot, and that was a way to make it sustainable. We sell ads against our videos, and so the more we put out, the way YouTube was designed in like around 2014, 2015, the more videos you put out each week, the more money you made. Now it's different. You could do one longer video and there's more room for ads throughout the video. It was the model that made sense to make Sideshow sustainable. Mm-hmm. But then at a certain point, once you have a system, it's actually harder to slow it down than to like to keep it, to scale it. Like, so many of the things we do, we're so used to doing them now. Let's see. I'm going to back up a little bit. Sorry, I'm not making sense.
It does make sense to me, but...
Okay. I'm just trying to think of, like, as an individual YouTuber, like, I don't want it to sound like we're just on this, like, hamster wheel that we can't get off of, because it's not that. It's that, like...
It's a process. You have a process that is well-defined.
Yeah. And there's lots of pieces. And it's run like a production company. We used to have these video editors or video makers, which you would make a whole YouTube video, which was exhausting. But now everybody does a different piece of it. You know, there's like the video editor makes the rough cut, but then the animator does all the like graphics and animation on it. And, you know, there's different layers to it. So everything's happening at the same time, but in different, at different points. And so at a certain point that becomes easier than making like one video, like one long video. Mm-hmm. I will say that that's the longer documentary style is something that we're always interested in. And so could live within like the SciShow workflow, but it would be like a different workflow than the like factory style that we have set up for the daily videos.
Okay. So your writers know that if they want to go outside to film something, it's out of reach for SciShow because it's not how you work.
That's right. Yeah. Because I think they know it wouldn't be cost effective for them to do that because they'd be spending more time and we would pay the same amount for that script. Yeah. You know, like if we're going to do a documentary style episode, which we've done before, but we've done it in-house and like had like a separate budget for that, that was different from the regular day-to-day operations.
Talking about money, I have a question that I asked you a few months ago and you didn't have the answer. And I'm asking it again now. Do you have any, because I'm really wondering, because it's a factory, you're expecting a factory to be very much cost effective. So I'm really wondering if you know how much an episode cost in SciShow, and if you are allowed to give that information, of course.
Yeah, I don't know if I... Let me figure this out. I'm so sorry. I meant to do this before. Okay. This is a pretty rough estimate because the reason... So we were talking about this at a baseball game in Alabama. I was like, I don't know. I was like, I could tell you what a script costs. I could tell you what an animation costs. But what does a whole SciShow episode cost? And the way I figured out is I could tell you what a minute of SciShow costs.
And it's by minute. Okay.
I think a minute costs $385, roughly.
Okay. So you have 11 minutes video. So let's say 3,000, like 4,000 for a 10 minutes video. That would be a rough estimate.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yes. Because if I compare... To me?
Yeah.
I'm going to assume that I'm paying myself the same as my editor, my video editor, because I'm not paying myself by videos. I'm
right.
So it doesn't work this way. But if I assume that I'm going to be paid the same amount as my per day as my editor, it would be the exact same cost as you.
Really?
Yeah. It's like 5,000 Canadian, which should be around 4,000 US.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Oh, that's something, there's something comforting in that for me.
I'm so surprised. I was expecting such a lower price.
No, there's more people.
So I'm cheap.
You're so cheap. No.
If I consider I consider like 8 days full time for a video from me, which is actually an average over several weeks, and I have my editors and I have other people working with me, but if I consider the price, the per day price of my editor should be around 5,000 Canadian.
Cool.
With so many people specialized, I was thinking that, I don't know, the turnaround would be quicker because I do things that I'm not good at. So it takes me time. So I would expect to have, with a big team, to have all of his mm-hmm. time reduced and then the price as well reduced.
Yeah, and I think it's probably the time is reduced, but the amount we spend on salary is increased because it's more people.
Yeah.
It's probably how it, and why you have, it evens out that way.
And you have also full-time people, which means more, you know, I work me with myself and have only, you know, freelancers, which is mm-hmm. Less expensive because you don't have all the benefits
right
to mm-hmm. pay for. So I yeah. think that plays a role as well. But that's interesting. That's very interesting. So that does mean yeah. that you need to find sponsors and a way to finance these videos. So what are the, if you are allowed to talk about it, how is SciShow financed?
It is paid for in lots of ways. Patreon is a huge one because that one is consistent. And it's this great, like, I always think of patrons as like our board. Like, like yeah. they like have opinions about how we should do things, like have ideas. If we're working with a sponsor who is new to what we do or wants us to do something that doesn't feel right to us, or are they worried that we might do something that doesn't feel right to them? I think patrons are a good thing to point to. Patreon is a good thing to point to. Is like, oh, we have all these people that we owe. Like they give us money every month mm-hmm. because they believe in how we do things and we need to stay true to that. So I love Patreon for so many reasons. So that's a big one. And that also extends to like YouTube channel members and things like that. And then AdSense on YouTube is a huge one. And especially as you get like a bigger back catalog, that is really helpful. And then direct sponsorships. And I think mm-hmm. those are, I always think of those three as the big parts of the braid. But then we also will license our content out. And that's more hit or miss.
What does it mean?
So like SciShow Kids is, it does not get a lot of money from sponsorships or from AdSense because you just don't want to advertise to kids, and that YouTube is gladly not set up that way. A lot of schools, a lot of parents, their kids are students directly on YouTube. And so we can license our kids' videos to other platforms that definitely don't have mm-hmm. ads, that have like other stuff like that can be used in a classroom or other features with it. And so we get paid. If you watch SciShow Kids on like an app that's not YouTube, we have probably licensed it to them and we are also getting paid for that. So that's like SciShow Kids' main source of revenue is licensing.
So it means that you also have people full-time, I'm guessing, that are here just to make sure to get money to yes. pay people.
Yes. Yeah. Kelsey Savage is our development director, chief development officer, I think is her title. And then she has a coordinator named Fiona, who I have not met. So I am blanking on their last name. But they work really, really hard to make sure mm-hmm. that Complexly, all the projects at Complexly have sponsors and partners. Another way we'll get funding sometimes is like definitely not worth it just for the funding, but a really fun, cool thing is that we'll work with, I don't want to say that, like the funding is worthwhile. I don't like, it's great, but it's more like, this is not how you're going to fund your whole YouTube channel. If it's pocket money. We work really hard for the money. Uh-huh. Working with scientists who have an NSF grant, because big part of an NSF grant mm-hmm. is sharing your information, your research with the public. And so we'll develop a video based on their research. That's like, if that was the main way you could make a YouTube channel, it would be amazing. Like mm-hmm. it would take forever. You'd have to have years
for sure
of not getting any money before you got anything. But working with scientists to translate their research into a YouTube video is super fun.
Okay.
And then merch is just something that SciShow is yeah. starting to gear up more towards. I don't know. I don't think anything has been announced yet, but they're working on a really cool project that is going to be very cool. That is, I think will be a good revenue builder, but also just like a fun, cool community builder.
You're teasing.
I know. If I was the EP, I would know the timeline and I could be like, oh, when is this coming out? And I could tell you exactly. But I don't want to spill.
Of course, no problem.
But I know, yeah, it's a cool thing that they're doing. But I can tell you about this project that I'm working on that is another source of revenue that it's kind of an experiment. So we're working with a group that creates science, like interactive exhibits, and we're working with a science museum, and then hopefully this will travel, but it'll open in Q1 of 2024. I'll send you, if this comes out then, Vivian, I can send you like more details nice. About exact things or a link to the video announcing it. But so we're working on a series of videos that will walk you through this really cool interactive science exhibit.
But so you have to be in Missoula.
You'll have to be in California.
California, okay.
Yeah, but then the hope is that it'll travel all around. And so you'll hopefully be able to see it in at least any North American.
Yeah.
But I think they're hoping it could travel internationally too.
Is it going to be the first time that SciShow is expanding to something that is on site?
I think so.
Ooh, that's exciting.
I think so. That is really exciting. Yeah.
And you're the one handling it.
Yeah. Well, I know SciShow very well. And so, but yeah, so it's been, it was a good experiment and a good, like, as I have been moving away from the day-to-day of SciShow, it's been a good way to like keep connected with SciShow.
Perfect. I think I have only one last question and then I'll let you go, which is about the financing of SciShow still. Mm-hmm. Do you have guidelines about who you accept to work with and who you don't accept to work with because it's educational?
Yes, we have organizations that we won't work with. We have organizations that we love working with, but we still always like keep a tight eye on how they're doing business. And there's great organizations like that I think are awesome that we won't work with because the scope of what they do is beyond just science. And so scientists who we work with would be made uncomfortable by a partnership with certain funders. And so we're like, we're not going to touch that. Like that, we don't want to make scientists uncomfortable. We want, that's, it's more important for us to have the trust of the scientific community than any question of where our funding's coming from. We are really appreciative of sponsors. But the way we frame what we're doing with them is that we really appreciate that they've sponsored the show and that they help keep SciShow free. Not that we never like recommend a product, even if we do recommend it and think it's great. It's just, we don't see that as our role. We usually put sponsorships for something. If it's like a direct product, like let's say it's a product that like cleans bathrooms. We wouldn't put that on a video about bathrooms, even if we have one coming out. We would be like, we don't want this to feel like a commercial. You can go on this episode about physics or something, you know, like, so that's a frustrating thing for sponsors, I think, is that they're like, oh, cool. Our product has a science association. Can you just make a science video about why our product's really great? And from a marketing perspective, I don't blame them for asking that, but,
of course,
but that's like, we're like, no, we're not going to just like use our audience like that and like lose our trust, lose the trust with our audience like that. At the company I work with now, so I love Complexly and I love SciShow and I still work with them, but I am trying to write fiction. And so I needed to switch to a part-time job and I wanted to switch to a part-time job that is associated with fiction writing. And so I work for Not Sorry Productions, which focuses on reading, like treating secular things as sacred. And so learning a lot from the reading that you do or anything that you interact with that you feel is dear. And so that's something, a project that I'm working on with them right now, is that like, I feel like every mission-driven organization or any project like needs to get money, but needs to like have a really clear understanding of like what is aligned with what we value and how do we treat our audience. And so both Complexly and Not Sorry are really, really thoughtful about that. But just to answer your question, it's like, yes, you need to like parameters and like rules around what you do, because sponsors are going to push you, you know, they're trying to sell their product and that's their job. And so you really have to have a deep understanding of what you'll do and mm-hmm. what the point of sponsorship is. And so the point of sponsorship for SciShow is sharing SciShow videos and getting them paid for, you know.
There is a push currently in France, in the French community, from the sponsors to us, that we are trying to resist, but that is already ongoing in the US, which is that, and now in the US you are accepting the sponsors to be at the beginning of the video and not at the end.
I know.
And before it was only at the end. And they are pushing for that in France as well. And we are trying to resist. And my agent told me, well, you're resisting now, but be prepared. It's going to change.
Right. So, SciShow resisted forever. And then we finally were like, you can have 10 seconds at the beginning.
Yeah.
And so we do a 10-second like teaser at the beginning. Maybe it might depend on it. And then we go into detail at the end.
Yeah, it's another world.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because it's like you want to be thoughtful of the audience. But then at a certain point, the audience is like, I don't want to pay for this content. So I will watch an ad in the middle as long as I can skip it. Or, you know, like, and so it is always like a little bit of a dance of like, when does it become like, so somebody was telling you, like, when does it become futile to resist it? Like, then is it like, oh, our audience actually doesn't care at this point anymore?
I don't know what to think, because some days I'm thinking, I'm sick of the ads. I'm going to shut it off from YouTube. I'm going to shut it off and then carry on with only Patreon, or which I couldn't do right now. But let's say, because I'm sick of it. And other days I'm like, well, if I want to finance what I do, there's an easy way. And it's right there. Just do it. Yeah. And people don't even care anymore. So it's, but the ad world is quite annoying.
Yeah. And it's like when you find a good sponsor that you like working with, you like, you'll do it, not anything, but you're like, yes. Like if you find somebody that like gets what you're doing, it's so wonderful.
Yeah.
And that's also though part of like, to your point of like why SciShow is so diverse in how we get funding, is because we want to be able to say no. And we want to be able to like do right by our patrons and stuff like that. So if you have a lot, like if one goes away for a little while, you can still stay afloat.
C'était Un Si Bon Terme, j'espère que ça vous a plu. N'hésitez pas à liker et à partager ce podcast depuis la plateforme de laquelle vous l'écoutez. Et puis nous on se retrouve pour un prochain épisode la prochaine fois. Bye.